Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello. Welcome to another episode of Say Why to Drugs. First of all, thanks for all the lovely feedback about the episode around alcohol and pregnancy. I'm really glad to hear it resonated with so many of you. Now on to this episode. And in this one, I spoke to James Nichols, who's CEO of an organisation called Transform. Now, you may have seen media reports in the last couple of weeks about a publication suggesting that stimulants should be regulated and legalised. This publication comes from Transform. It's exploring what evidence-based regulation of stimulants might look like. The organisation have also published a similar document looking at cannabis regulation a few years ago. I spoke to James about both of these documents. What are some of the issues that regulating currently illicit drugs need to consider? And what happened when some places did start to regulate cannabis? It's quite a different conversation to ones I've previously had on Say Why to Drugs, where the topic of regulation is something, to be honest, I've slightly steered clear of. So I'm really keen to know what you make of it. Once you've listened, do let me know on Instagram, Twitter, or anywhere really. But for now, please enjoy as James Nichols and I say why to regulation of drugs. Great. So I guess, first of all, can I get you to introduce yourself?
Yeah. So I'm James Nichols. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of Transform Drug Policy Foundation.
And can you tell us a little bit about what Transform is?
Yeah. So Transform is a charity which is based in Bristol mainly, but also in London. It's been around for about 20 years and it advocates for drug policy reform. Our goal is to promote drug policy that supports human rights, social justice and public health. For many years, Transform has been one of the leading organisations that has set out alternatives to drug prohibition. So one of the things that Transform does particularly is try to develop practical models for alternatives to prohibition. So setting out ways in which we can effectively regulate legally currently illegal drugs. I'd also say that Transform also has a campaign called Anyone's Child, which works with families of people or families themselves who've been directly affected by drug policy or drug harms who are campaigning for changes to drug law as well. So we've got an aspect of our work which is about research and evidence and think tank element. We've got a campaigning aspects, and as I say, we work with people working in policy, people working in treatment and people directly affected.
Now, I feel like I should probably address the fact that in my podcast, in Say Why to Drugs to date, I've kind of steered clear of talking about things like policy and legality, other than sort of talking about the facts of sort of what we know about, like what the law says at the moment kind of thing. But it's something that comes up all the time when I do public events. People are really interested in this issue and interested in particular in sort of, well, what's the evidence around it? Like, does how we treat drugs at the moment work in terms of protecting people, protecting lives, protecting health, protecting the economy, protecting the prison system? You know, there's all these different aspects of life that are affected by drugs and by drug laws. And as the conversations around drugs have been changing in the past few years, at least, with criminalization, legalization, regulation changing across the world in different places, particularly around cannabis. And maybe that's a good place to start this conversation. It's something that's very much in and around the sort of the media and public consciousness. So it feels like a good time to actually talk about it on the podcast. So maybe we can start with, there's all these different words around the ways that we can treat drugs in terms of the law. Things like decriminalisation, legalisation and regulation. But they don't mean the same thing, do they?
No, they don't. And it's a confusion that is very widespread, and understandably so, given that I think people's general experience of drug policy is that drugs are illegal, and so alternatives to that are much the same thing. But as you say, they are different. So in the case of decriminalisation, what we're talking about there is the removal of criminal penalties primarily for possession of drugs. And that can take different forms, from programmes which divert people who are would otherwise be arrested and put into the criminal justice system for possession of drugs, through to a principle whereby you simply remove all criminal penalties at all for possession. So there's variations, and there are many, many countries that have forms of decriminalisation across the world, and they take many different, there are many different versions of that. The difference between that and a legal regulation model is that legal regulation would involve the formal moving of drug supply itself into a regulated system, which would then be much more like the systems we have for, say, tobacco or alcohol or pharmaceuticals. So I guess the kind of simple distinction between decriminalisation and legal regulation is that one tackles removal of criminal penalties for possession, and the other takes the market as a whole and seeks to establish a regulated system of licensing for supply as well. So in the former case, the supply generally still remains illegal and subject to criminal sanctions. In the latter, there's an attempt to create a kind of holistic market system for the regulated supply of drugs which are currently illegal.
Now, Transform have just written a document about what regulation of stimulants could look like. And we'll come on to talk about that in a bit, but I think it might be better to start with cannabis, since this is something where there are different countries around the world have started down this road towards either decriminalisation or regulation of cannabis. And there's lots and lots of different ways that you can do that. So Transform wrote a document a few years ago now about cannabis. What was the purpose of that document?
So, yeah, I mean, as I say, I think one of the things that Transform has always sought to do is to say, well, OK, if people feel that the war on drugs, or however you want to describe it, has been a failure, then there's a responsibility then to go, well, OK, what would the alternatives look like, and how can we lay them out in some detail? So, I mean, back in 2009, in fact, Transform published a book called After the War on Drugs, Blueprint for Regulation, which sketched out a general model for the regulation of currently illegal drugs. And then some years later, we published a book called How to Regulate Cannabis, A Practical Guide, which was specifically geared towards laying out a regulatory model for cannabis, which implemented or applied public health principles to that market. So our goal in writing that book was to try and lay out in detail how you would establish a system which provided for the legal supply of cannabis, but did so in such a way that you could promote public health and, well, social justice as far as is possible. Now, that book's being revised at the moment because, actually, as you say, since that book came out, we've seen transformations in the cannabis market globally, particularly Canada and a number of US states, also Uruguay, Jamaica, other countries as well. And what that has shown us, and it shouldn't be a surprise, is A, that there are many different ways of establishing legal markets, and that often small differences between those markets can have significant impacts in terms of outcomes, but also that there are things that maybe were not sufficiently planned for or predicted when this was still hypothetical. And one of those is the extent to which ensuring social justice in a legalized market is actually very difficult and needs to be really carefully thought about. And secondarily, just how difficult it can be and how important it is to establish systems which ensure that you don't simply end up with the emergence of powerful multinational corporate interests in the cannabis space who in some ways mirror the kind of interest that you have in the alcohol and tobacco space. Because if you're approaching this from a public health perspective, that's not what you want. You want to have a system which promotes public health, which doesn't simply promote a profit-driven commercialization.
Can we just clarify, what do we mean by social justice in this context?
One of the kind of primary arguments for reforming drug policy is that the prohibition of drugs in its history was always linked to race politics. So in the UK, for example, the ban on opium in the early 20th century was connected to politics around Chinese immigration in London. And the same is true in the West Coast of America as well. Clearly, later in the 20th century, the extent to which both creation of laws against cannabis and cocaine use, the implementation of those laws, and the way in which those laws were talked about and discussed in the public was absolutely related to race politics. And we have seen the extent to which the implementation of drug laws have led to the mass incarceration of black people, particularly in North America, but also the disproportionate use of police forces across the world and in the UK. So there's an absolute relationship between black communities in particular, but also people of colour across society who have been disproportionately impacted by drug policy. And so one of the kind of major arguments for reform has been, well, we've had effectively a system which has been racist in its design and its implementation to a large degree. The goal of reforming that is to address those racial inequalities, to address that legacy and that history of racism. But the difficulty is how do you actually achieve that? Because if you're not careful, what you can do is you can take something like the cannabis market, and the communities who have been hit hardest by the prohibition of that market being black communities primarily, and again in the United States this is a particular issue. If then in creating a legal market you don't proactively put in place systems whereby the records of convictions, for example, for possession or supply are addressed, or if you don't put in proactively systems whereby people from communities that have been disproportionately impacted by the war on drugs are not empowered to and supported to become part of the new market, what you may end up with, and has been the case to some degree, is you have a replacement of the existing market with a market that is dominated by large multinational, largely white-led organisations, which then just step in and mop up all the profits of the legal trade, whilst you continue to criminalise and marginalise people of colour who have been criminalised and marginalised by the prohibition system which preceded it. Ensuring social justice in that context is about saying, what are the specific aspects of the legislation that we need to put in place to ensure that, on the one hand, the legacy of criminalisation which goes back generations is addressed. So things like expunging prior convictions for drug-related offences so that people don't have that on their record any longer. And secondarily, how do you establish licensing regimes, for example, or training systems whereby you proactively support people from communities that have been disproportionately affected into the new markets, that they have a stake in those markets going forward?
So when you're trying to kind of design or advise on what the best kind, for want of a better word, of regulation would look like, how do you go about weighing up the evidence? Because there's obviously lots of different aspects to this question, and what might be the best market in terms of public health would be different in terms of social justice, would be different in terms of the criminal or processing cannabis, or, you know, there's all these different factors that you need to weigh up. So how do you go about doing that, or how did you go about doing that when writing the report?
Yeah, I mean, it's in some respects a difficult thing to do, because if you're trying to model policy on the basis of an existing system where, if you have an existing system prohibition, you're trying to model a system of legal regulation. You don't have prior markets on which to base the evidence for those proposals. So you have to kind of do it by proxy to an extent. So, you know, you have to look at, well, what are the lessons you can learn, say, from the history of alcohol regulation, which is something that, you know, prior to joining Transform, I was very involved in. And we have, in the case of alcohol, and we have it to a degree in the case of tobacco as well, a very long and rich history that we can learn from around licensing and how licensing can best promote public health outcomes, around different models for supply, around the risks of corporate capture and commercialization promoting harm. I think one of the points you touch on there, which I think is interesting, is that in some respects, trying to think through how you can establish markets that address issues of criminalization, marginalization, and market access, and how you design systems that promote public health by addressing issues around price, availability, and marketing, which we know in the case of alcohol and tobacco are drivers of public health harms, is complicated, because in some respects you need to be looking at ways in which you, but also actually the third issue that you need to be doing is how do you penetrate illegal markets in such a way that people actually shift to the legal regime. And that is complicated, and we don't have precedent to work from directly. So we have to take what we know about, for example, the relationship between, I don't know, outlet density, consumption and harm in the case of alcohol. But we also need to think about, well, how do we ensure that we don't reduce availability to an extent whereby the current illegal market just doesn't really get touched by it, which is something that in Canada people are having to think about now, because one of the questions that's been looked at in Canada is, has the market in some respects been too restrictive so that it's left a residual illegal market fairly much in place? Those are very complicated questions. And we have evidence, as I say, from legal drug markets, tobacco and alcohol in particular. But quite a lot of what we need to be doing here is saying, well, let's collectively think through what the options are for the future. And as regulatory models are implemented, ensure as far as is possible that proper evaluation is put in place so that we can assess the impacts of those newly regulated markets and adapt those markets as they go along. So again, as I say, in the case of Canada, fortunately, they've got a fairly good evaluation process going on, and we're able to start looking at that and reflect on that, and people are able to think about how those systems might be amended or tweaked or done differently to address either unintended consequences or unpredicted consequences, or to maximise things that are working.
Because one of the things that's being talked about quite a lot in the sort of academic research literature about cannabis at the moment is potency. And obviously that's something where there has to be a kind of trade-off in terms of thinking about regulation between potentially high THC cannabis being particularly risky in terms of public health or and individual health, compared to if you allow the only legal product to be so low potency but people won't actually make the switch from the illicit market to the legal market.
Yeah, I mean, that is something where I think we can look at alcohol, actually. And over time in alcohol markets, both reasons of health, but also for reasons of just simplifying the taxation systems, we have a fairly kind of elaborate kind of regulatory structure in terms of taxation around relating potency to tax levels, certainly in the UK at least, and certainly for beer in the UK, less so for some of the other forms of alcohol. But also I think we have a relatively sophisticated understanding of the relationship between the strength of products and the effects they have. I think the problem with the cannabis market is that we're actually not very literate, less so I think amongst kind of people who are regularly using cannabis, who have a better kind of idea of strength. But I think generally within society we're not very literate around that relationship between strength, harm, and how we can use things like the tax system, things like the licensing system to address that. I think you're right that to a degree, and this has been something that I think Canada has found, is that if the product available on the legal market doesn't meet the demand that is being met by the illegal market will simply continue to provide that product. However, I don't think that the alternative to that is simply to say, well, the legal market is just going to have to provide the most powerful concentrates, the most powerful edibles, and just allow them to become part of the legal market. I think that there are all sorts of nudges and tweaks that can be put in place whereby you say, okay, well, you know, we'll scale up the legal market so that it meets that demand. But we will ensure that in doing that, we use particularly, I think, taxation effectively so that there's a relationship between the kind of cost of products, both for producers and for consumers, and the strength of those products, as is the case to a degree for beer, for example, in the UK, where taxation goes up by strength, but also things like minimum unit pricing in the UK, of course, where you can try and nudge the market by having better systems for linking price to strength.
In places where cannabis regulation has begun, how have the way that these states or countries introduced it compared to what you recommended in your document? Like, and how well do you think different places are doing in terms of regulation of cannabis?
It's a very good question. And what's happening is we're seeing a series of natural experiments going on, particularly in the United States, because individual states are doing it differently. To some degree, you know, we were pleased to see that the Canadian government in particular incorporated quite a lot of the ideas that were there in our book, you know, around plain packaging, around limitations to marketing, around trying to ensure that availability and outlet density was thought about in such a way that you could, you know, avoid the worst forms of a kind of a unregulated commercial market. Having said which, I think that one of the big flaws with the Canadian model, and possibly something that in our previous editions of the book, which is actually being addressed in the new edition, is that understanding the extent to which the social justice part of the jigsaw really, really needs to be thought through practically is something that just wasn't really there in Canada. Canada was focusing on public health and protection of young people, which are important things, and reducing the size of the illegal market, but it wasn't focused enough on social justice. If you compare that to some of the states in North America, in the United States, sorry, you see that some states, Massachusetts, for example, has been much more proactive in trying to address the social justice aspect. So it has instituted licensing systems where the cost thresholds are low enough that people from poorer communities can get involved in the market, where limitations on the number of outlets that any individual company can hold are designed to a degree to try and ensure that you don't get monopolization of markets by big corporates, where training systems are put in place to bring people into the market. On the other hand, if you look at places like California, where they've been more proactive in terms of expunging prior convictions for drug-related offences, and have tried quite hard to address that part of the jigsaw. What we're seeing, I think, from Transform's perspective is, in some respects, in places like Canada and Uruguay in particular, really positive outcomes in terms of trying to focus on public health, much more varied in the United States, where, you know, you get some states such as Colorado, where the design is much more of a commercial market. But also that we're learning, and I think everyone is learning at the same time, that particularly around the social justice piece, that there are many different ways of approaching that, and none are perfect, and that we all need to be, all of us who are involved in trying to think around regulation, need to really do some hard thinking about how do you practically learn from what's going on and develop strong recommendations that are applicable in different jurisdictions around social justice, and also around dealing with that tension between public health promotion and providing enough availability that the legal market provides a reasonably attractive alternative for consumers.
One of the things I think that people worry about in terms of legalization of drugs is drugs are illegal because they're harmful, right? And so if we legalize drugs, are we not just saying that we're encouraging people to use them, or that lots more people who wouldn't have used them under an illegal system would now think, oh, well, they're legal now, so I should go and try them and potentially put themselves at risk?
Yeah, I mean, our view on that is that we need to regulate drugs because they're potentially harmful, because what you have otherwise is a market which is entirely unregulated and which doesn't appear to shrink despite decades of prohibition. You have markets that are just expanding and that have associated harms which arise entirely from the illegality of those markets. So, for example, there's a paper that's just come out in Addiction Journal by Claire Wilkinson and Alison Ritter, which is looking at cost to others studies in alcohol and asking whether they could also be applied to currently illegal drugs. And one of the interesting points that that article raises is that when you look at the harm to others caused by alcohol, they are generally on the consumption side. So people getting involved in violence or becoming ill themselves or whatever else it may be, or costs to the health service around consumption. But if you look at the currently illegal drug market, huge amounts of the what you would class as harms to others come from the fact that the supply is illegal. So whether that's the exploitation of producers, the incalculable levels of corruption and violence that are experienced by transit countries such as Mexico, the violence and exploitation of supply, whether that be county lines networks, whether that be the kind of extent to which the markets are characterized by opposing suppliers fighting it out for market territory. All of those additional harms are directly linked to the illegality of the market. Now, I take your point that you could say, well, there's a kind of signaling that comes from having certain drugs remain illegal, which is to say that as a society, by proxy, through our regulatory position, we are saying that these drugs are dangerous. But we know, or certainly the kind of comparative studies that have been done by David Nutt and others, if you look kind of objectively at the harms associated with different drugs, alcohol is right there at the very top, as you well know from those studies. And that's not to say that we have a perfect market for alcohol. It's very badly regulated at the moment, or in some respects, it's very badly regulated. But to say that for all of the substances which were lumped together in the United Nations Conventions of 1961 and 1971, that we have this one-size-fits-all approach to those substances, which is you simply make the market illegal and you criminalise supply and you criminalise use, that will send this signal, and that the associated costs in terms of health harms, violence, exploitation, lack of access to support and treatment are a price is worth paying to send that signal. It's something that, I mean, Transform, we don't accept. And our argument is that it's because of the risks associated with drugs. It's because you need to have systems in place whereby you can take as much as is possible the market out of the kind of hands of essentially transnational organized crime, which is operating completely parallel to formally regulated markets, that is the approach that you need to take, or at least, you know, seriously consider that as the alternative way of doing things, because there is precious little evidence that the way things are being done at the moment is achieving anything like the outcomes which it's supposed to achieve. You know, I mean, just to kind of like think about the way that the United Nations itself talks about this. You know, every few years, I mean, in 2009, for example, you know, the United Nations put out its 10-year drug policy, and with the goal of achieving a drug-free world within 10 years. That was the goal, was to achieve a drug-free world. It's kind of reasonable to ask yourself, how have we got ourselves into a situation where the United Nations collectively and collaboratively, in all seriousness, presents as its policy goal a drug-free world? I mean, that's objectively irrational. It's not going to happen. And if that's your goal, if your goal is something that is utopian and unachievable in that respect, as we know, when you have kind of utopian goals, the means become skewed and you end up engaging in all sorts of activities and all sorts of behaviours which are damaging in themselves because you're pursuing an impossible outcome. And I don't think that's easily discounted. I don't think we should simply say, oh, well, but it's a good idea to try and have a drug-free world, isn't it? Because I think when you do that, then you end up pursuing policies and actually legitimising things like the war on drugs in the Philippines, which has cost tens and tens of thousands of lives and countless extrajudicial killings and a complete you know, perversion of the rule of law, and you look at the violence in places like Mexico, I don't think it's good enough for us to just go, well, you know, drug-free world's a good idea, though, isn't it? It's neither achievable nor does it lead to activities which are just, which promote human rights or which promote public health.
Well, and it's just really hypocritical as well, because a drug-free world would mean an alcohol-free world, and no one's suggesting that.
Exactly. And this is the other problem with the system that we have in place at the moment. One of the big problems with it is it creates this cognitive illusion which says, on the one hand, you have alcohol, and on the other hand, you have drugs, as if currently illegal drugs are in any way similar to each other in any other respect than the fact that they are psychoactive and illegal. And also that alcohol somehow has this free pass, despite the fact that it's a powerfully psychoactive substance. It's, you know, it's powerfully, as anyone who's ever been really drunk knows perfectly well, it's powerfully psychoactive. It is, you know, there's a significant proportion of consumers who either become problematic, who have problematic use or dependency. It's associated with all sorts of negative externalities in terms of behaviour and harm, and yet gets a free pass, whereas all other drugs, whether it be heroin, LSD, ketamine, cocaine, MDMA, are all put in a basket marked illegal drugs. We need to eradicate them from the world. It's that lack of nuance. It's that kind of binary, clunky sledgehammer to crack a nut approach which emerges out of our current system, which has all these terrible consequences in terms of policy. And it's not just a principle that we need to be more nuanced, it's the practical reality of the fact that it leads to absurdities like people having their lives hugely impacted by, say, you know, a conviction for possession of MDMA, let's say. In what respect is that a positive outcome for that individual or for society? And if we do think that's the case, if we can see the hypocrisy in that, and we can see the damage that that does, then we have to, Transform's view is, and my view is, that we have to say, okay, well, if that's not working, or if that's creating these catastrophic social, political consequences, we have to consider what the alternatives are, and we have to work through them. We have to lay them out, and we have to compare them and say, well, do we think that'll work? Does that work? Should we try that? How can we assess and evaluate the impact of these alternatives? And I think, as is often the case for many people, to kind of go, oh, well, it's the status quo. It's just, I can't think of, you know, it's too complicated, or it's bad, but what can you do? You know, it just doesn't really work. I think everyone needs to at least consider what the alternatives might be.
Now, we've talked about cannabis legalization and regulation, and in a way that's a good starting point, because more people have tried cannabis than other currently illicit drugs, certainly in the UK and in lots of other places. It's seen as, obviously there are health risks from using cannabis, but it's seen as relatively benign, certainly by a lot of people, or potentially beneficial by a lot of other people as well. But you've just written a report about stimulants, and that is quite a bit more of a controversial issue to some people, the thought of legalizing something like cocaine or methamphetamine or even MDMA. So what were the different kind of issues you had to think about when thinking about a regulated market for stimulants compared to cannabis?
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. It is a much more difficult issue and much more difficult area. And just to say, you know, I think one of the great things about Transform has always been that it's been prepared to go there and say, look, here's the territory you may feel uncomfortable with. We will explore that territory and attempt to lay out what that territory looks like in terms of a regulated system. It's absolutely the case that for stimulants, the questions are different and they're much more harder to address. And it doesn't really have that kind of cover of medicinal use that you have for cannabis, and to a degree for psychedelics as well, because as you'll know, the debate around psychedelics right now is very much driven around medical use. That's not the case. So what we were, you know, what we've had to do in terms of thinking about stimulants, and again, to go back to my previous point, there's a kind of a clunkiness even in that we're looking at cocaine, amphetamines and MDMA, which in their own ways are very different. Have different use and risk profiles. I think what it forces the issue of is that once you remove the cover, as it were, of medicinal use, you're forced to confront what is that fundamental question about, okay, if you have substances out there that people wish to use for essentially either recreational or to some degree functional, in the case of amphetamines in particular, you know, there are many, a large proportion of amphetamines that are used globally are used simply to keep people awake when they're working long hours. So there's a functional use, but there's, you know, when you're thinking about substances that are used primarily for recreational purposes, that raises all sorts of further questions then about, and again, it goes back to alcohol. On what basis do we determine which forms of recreation are acceptable? On what basis do we balance the risks of use to the user and the externality, the external harms to other people of a substance against the rights of individuals to use substances recreationally, and how do we do that in a way that promotes public health? So it kind of forces a discussion whereby we don't kind of get, it's not so much sidetracked down the issue of medicinal use, but that's just not part of the equation. So if essentially what we were having to do was go, well, okay, how would you create a market in which these substances were made available in different ways depending on their risk profiles, but also in ways that does not allow for a kind of marketization whereby, as is the case with alcohol, the recreational or pleasurable aspects of that drug become the driver for a marketized system which seeks primarily to increase consumption, and particularly to do so amongst that smaller proportion of the consuming population who consume most of the substance. Because as we know, that kind of Pareto distribution works across most substances, if not all. And transform, because it comes at it from a harm reduction and public health perspective, what we have attempted to lay out is, realistically speaking, how would you create that? How would you allow for the decriminalisation of possession and the legal regulation of supply in a way that does not, at the same time, allow for the fact that these drugs can be fun for people to become the engine of a marketized system which seeks to increase consumption in the way that we've seen with alcohol. So that was those are the questions we had to address, and we had to wrestle with them. They're very, very difficult questions, but that's what we were having to think about in putting the book together.
And so what are some of the conclusions that you came to after sort of weighing up the evidence and looking at different potential options?
We had to think about things like, I mean, marketing's one of the more easy ones. You have to think about things like, okay, what do you do around marketing? Do you go down a kind of the route of alcohol, where marketing is regulated, but it's by and large self-regulated by the industry in other respects, is there to both promote individual brands, but also to promote the product itself. It was not a particularly difficult one for us in that our view was that marketing for allowing marketing in any kind of conventional way for the substances we're talking about would not be acceptable. I mean, that was one of the simpler issues we had to address. I think more complicated was things like, if you take how you license the supply of a drug, if you take the case of alcohol in the UK, for example, where you have local licensing authorities that are tasked with controlling the availability, both in terms of numbers of outlets and the hours at which they operate in their local area, in theory, that should allow for a fairly kind of tight control of those things. But in practice, they don't, because local authorities are simply not powerful enough to stand up against the collective might and wealth of the alcohol industry. And so what you see is that local licensing regimes actually very rarely reject licenses and very rarely turn down applications for extensions of hours. Given the prospect of a similar system for stimulants, we recognise that would probably not work. And so we are proposing a model which is much more based around pharmacy style outlets, where we have trained suppliers, where the whole supply chain is effectively a state monopoly, as is the case for off sales of alcohol, say, in a number of provinces in Canada and in large parts of Scandinavia. These are not ideas which are out of the blue. They are still based on existing models. So that's where we came down, which was a state monopoly of supply, so that the profit, the private profit motive, is removed as much as possible. Retail through specialist pharmacies. So we're not saying you can just stick stimulants on the shelves in corner shops or supermarkets, or even sell in clubs and pubs, because there are all sorts of issues there around, as we know, with the sale of alcohol, around regulating the amount that people are able to purchase and the way in which it's consumed. So it's a very restrictive model that we're putting forward, actually. It's a very tightly controlled model. But that comes out of the fact that the thing that we are most concerned, or one of the things we're most concerned to avoid, is the kind of mistakes that have been made, where you have lightly or poorly regulated alcohol markets and previously very poorly regulated tobacco markets. Because we know that given the opportunity, and commerce being commerce, it will seek to find gaps in the regulation. So from our perspective, the way in which you can do this most effectively is by modelling on the kind of state monopolies for alcohol that you have in Scandinavia and parts of the rest of the world, and which were much more common earlier in the 20th century as well.
Your report also takes the sort of the risk from the substance itself into account as well, doesn't it? So there wouldn't necessarily be the same regulation for buying a tablet of MDMA compared to sort of injectable crystal meth, for example.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, this again goes back to that point that it's not a matter of saying keep all drugs illegal or make all drugs legal as if it's a binary. What it's a matter of saying is, we need to create regulatory systems that properly reflect the risks associated with drugs, and that the availability of those substances is based on those risks. So, for example, yes, injectable stimulants, crack cocaine also, our proposal is for those to be available, but available through a prescription supply, similar to the kind of thing we have around heroin prescribing, where you're talking then about a much more medicalized context for supply, which again, it's interesting in the case of heroin in the UK. You know, it is legal to prescribe heroin. It used to be much more commonplace. It's not, you know, the evidence for heroin, prescribed heroin globally, is very strong in terms of the outcomes it can achieve. In that respect, in terms of stimulants for injectable stimulants and for crack cocaine, that's the kind of model that we're looking at, is saying, well, can we facilitate that as well? Can we allow that also for these other substances, which currently the law just doesn't allow that flexibility? And so you end up with all supply being in the illicit market, and you don't have that lever whereby you can bring people into treatment and support, partly through having regulated provision as part of that capability. The law as it stands is just too clunky and inflexible to allow that.
So I guess my last question is, what do you think is going to happen with this document then? Do you think countries are going to look at it and say, maybe we should legalise and regulate stimulants? Can you see that happening? And if it is going to happen, where is it likely to happen first?
As we speak, a bill is being debated in the Colombian Senate to legally regulate cocaine. And we were involved in conversations with the senators who drafted that legislation, that bill. And they took on board some of the ideas that we have in the book. We're already, it's not a direct consequence of the book itself, but we're already seeing attempts by countries to seriously start putting into that legislative domain, even if at this stage it is for debate, the kind of proposals, and both indirectly and directly influenced by Transform's thinking, for legal regulation. And it's interesting that Colombia is going first, because in some ways it's not surprising when you look at the countries that have been most kind of savagely impacted by the war on drugs, that they will be the countries that may be the first to say, look, now that we're starting to see actual practical proposals for alternative, let's put those on the legislative table. Let's start that process. Let's get that debate going. Now, how long that might take or where that might go next is impossible to read. But what we really hope from this book, I think, is that it creates an environment in which people start to say, okay, well, great, we've now got a template, we've now got a model. We may disagree with details of that model. We may disagree with it substantially or only in part, but we've now got something from which we can start to have that proper debate whereby we seriously say, okay, if we don't think the war on drugs is working, and given that if we don't think that, we have a responsibility to consider the alternatives, here is at the very least, if not the final word on what those alternatives might be, here is a substantially thought through, detailed laying out of what an alternative system which is based on public health and social justice and human rights might look like. Let's work from that. Let's get that discussion moved from a kind of, isn't it terrible? This is awful. If only it would end, kind of a discussion, to a discussion of, well, here is what the alternatives might look like. And hope, and also in doing that, I think hopefully allow people to feel confident that they can have that conversation without it just seeming like a kind of weird thing to do. So people can go, well, there's actually this, you know, there's a 300 odd pages of fairly kind of technical laying out of this stuff. It's a perfectly reasonable, responsible thing to do, because I think in some respects the hardest thing about this is A, giving people a kind of, what do you call it, a kind of nucleation point, I suppose, a kind of starting point from which people can then develop those discussions. But it's also allowing people to have the confidence to think, look, talking about legal regulation of drugs, including stimulants, is not some kind of crazy pie in the sky thing. It's a reasonable thing to do. It's a rational thing to do. It's something whereby we can look at evidence, we can make political judgments, we can think about practical models for regulation, and we can discuss and debate the pros and cons of those models, and that is both important and perfectly achievable. And from our perspective, I think if we can move the debate in some way, and hopefully significantly, into a place where we go from, I suppose, the kind of analysis of the failures of the drug war, critical as those are and vital as that is to continue to do that work of analysing where those failures are happening and who they are impacting on, into also a substantial, meaningful discussion of the alternatives and a weighing of the pros and cons of those alternatives and a testing of those alternatives and a critique of those alternatives, that's all fine, that's all good. But to move into that territory, I think we'll have achieved a huge amount, and I'm really, really hoping that's where we go with this.
Fantastic. Well, that seems like a great place to wrap it up. So thank you so much, James Nichols from Transform.
Thank you, Susie.
And there we are. Thanks so much for listening. As I said in the intro, this topic is something I've not really covered before, so I'm really keen to hear what you make of it. Do you have any questions that you wish that I'd put to James? Do you agree or disagree with any of the assertions made? I'd really love to hear from you. And if I get loads of questions, James has said that he's happy to come back on and answer some of them. So please do get in touch. Thanks to James for taking the time to speak with me. Thank you for listening, and join us next time where we'll have the live episode recorded earlier this year at Vault Festival, looking at what we know about the relationship between drugs and sex. See you then. Bye.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.